She called it the problem that has no name, and then she proceeded to name it. And the name stuck. She was Betty Friedan, and the problem was the feminine mystique, which was also the title of her groundbreaking book, published 50 years ago this month. As the feminine mystique enters its golden age, NPR's Lynn Neary looks back on its origins and explores its legacy.
Since it was first published in 1963, millions of people have read The Feminine Mystique. These days, a lot of people read it in college, often in women's studies classes. Even so, when we talked with some young women in downtown Washington, D.C., many knew little or nothing about it.
Should I be ashamed that I don't?
I have no idea.
I've heard of it as like a powerful piece that has been influential.
Elise Cedar, Christy Russell, and Samantha Larson can be forgiven for not feeling the urgency to read The Feminine Mystique that their mothers might have felt. It is most likely hard for them to understand the way things were when Betty Friedan decided she had had enough. New York Times columnist Gail Collins was a teenager when the book first came out.
There's very seldom that you get a book that is so of the moment.
It was post-World War II America. The suburbs were growing exponentially. The economy was booming. A lot of women had worked outside the home during the war. A significant number of women had gotten a college education. Now, they were all being told to stay home and find their fulfillment in taking care of their husbands.
She's got a man she's promised to love, honor, and...
keep house for the right way.
Does that mean I never have to help with the dishes?
Never. Belle does my dishes.
The moment was so pregnant and ready for an explosion that all you needed was somebody just sitting there saying, look at that ad. They think you're so stupid. They hate you. They really have contempt for you. Take a look at that again. That's all you needed.
When Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, she was both a suburban housewife and a freelance writer who worked mostly for women's magazines, which were run by men. The book, says Collins, was neither a sociological tract nor a political manifesto.
It's totally personal. You know, the great criticisms of the book over the years, all of which are certainly true, that it didn't take into account working women, that it didn't take into account minority women. Those people are totally absent. Laws are totally absent. Discrimination in the workplace, none of that stuff. It's all a very personal, white, middle-class, college-educated woman's howl of misery and anger at the place where she's found herself.
Hannah Rosen, author of The End of Men, was in her 20s when she first read the book. She was surprised by how personal it was, and by Friedan's anger as she systematically laid out the case against a male-dominated society that was determined to keep women in their place.
We don't write with that kind of anger and rage anymore. It's not exactly sociological. It so takes on every element of society and essentially explains how it's totally colluded to create this set of expectations for women, which were fake. I mean, you suddenly feel like you have this really real feeling that you've been caught in a conspiracy. And I'm extremely resistant to conspiratorial kind of thinking. And yet, you know, you feel like, oh my God, like it came from the magazines, it came from the universities, it came from our fathers, it came from our mothers, it came from grade school, you know, it came from every level that there was this collusion to feed this message from women.
50 years later, Rosen says The Feminine Mystique is still relevant, especially when it comes to our understanding of women and domesticity.
We still thoroughly associate women with domesticity and keeping of the home. There's some argument to make that this circumscribed world that Betty Friedan was describing, I wouldn't say it made women happier, but it made one at least know what one's place was in the world and not have this sense that everything was up for grabs and you had to be good in every single sphere, like taking care of the home, taking care of the children, you know, working at your job, being ambitious. And so women haven't really given up the spheres that she described they control. They've just taken on lots of new ones.
I see a lot of people feeling discouraged that we're still having the same conversation.
Jessica Valenti is a feminist author and writer. At 34, she says women her age and younger are actively engaged with feminism, but not necessarily in traditional forums. They're on the web and social media, trying to figure out how to move the discussion forward.
We've seen all of these policy changes. We've seen incredible laws. We've seen Roe. We've seen the Violence Against Women Act. But we're still kind of fighting for implementation, and we're still really battling the cultural battle and looking for cultural shifts.
Valenti says one of Betty Friedan's most powerful legacies is her anger. She says young women shy away from that emotion because they don't want to be labeled angry feminists.
But we forget that that anger is justified and that it's okay to be angry and that anger can be useful and energizing. I think that anger around sexism, around income inequality, around domestic inequality is really righteous and really relatable.
So if you want to understand the passion that helped fire up the modern women's movement, there may be no better place to start than with the feminine mystique. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
There are lots of places these days to look for all kinds of love, especially online. But what's an aging intellectual who loves William Gass, Philip Glass, and a good Merlot to do? The distinguished New York Review of Books celebrates its 50th anniversary this month. It is noted for its rigorous writing and stellar cerebral lit stars, and for its personal ads. For example,
Antediluvian Mariner seeks attractive coxswain to put in at terra firma amidst coming torrents. Long-term relationship inevitable. Will steer clear of Mount Ararat in protest of Armenian genocide. Mont Blanc? Open to suggestions.
The New York Review's associate publisher, Catherine Tice, joins us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Do you have any idea how the personals got started, and was there some skepticism at first?
I don't know what the story was, but I do have the very first personal ad from the July 11th, 1968 issue. It's very succinct.
Wife wanted. Intelligent, beautiful, 18 to 25, broad-minded, sensitive, affectionate, for accomplished artist and exciting life. NYR Box 1432.
I had no idea my ad would wind up there all these years later. Does it work? Do you have any indication?
We've had some success stories. We've been told of marriages and alliances of many kinds. I do have here, this is a recent response. She says, the men who responded to the personal ad I placed in the New York Review of Books in 2012 have literally knocked my socks off. I wish there was a venue to spend a few hours with each to discover their fascinating background stories. I've communicated with correspondents and authors, international businessmen, financial experts, and many others. There is no question that I have met and will continue to meet meaningful people through the NYRB.
Does it say something about the New York Review, do you think?
I think that they reflect a readership intellectually engaged, intellectually curious, interested in politics and culture, certainly, and the arts and science, and sort of unabashedly happy to state that they wish to share those things with others. And that doesn't preclude more sort of quotidian descriptions of oneself as being tall or small or thin or fat or old or young. If an armchair radical who's 25 seeks dialectical synthesis with street credible Jacobin female, must have nothing to lose but chains, absence of property a plus. I wonder who will please that fellow, but I imagine there's a reader of the Review who will.
Catherine Tice is associate publisher of the New York Review of Books. Happy anniversary. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Cupid, draw back your bow and let your arrow go.
This is NPR News.
50 years ago this week, American poet Sylvia Plath committed suicide. She was 30 years old. Commentator Tess Taylor has this reflection on how she reads Plath's work today.
The details of Sylvia Plath's death are famous even outside of poetry. Depressed and separated from her husband, poet Ted Hughes, she stuck her own head in an oven, putting a dramatic end to her ambitious life. In addition to two small children, she left behind the wiry electric poems that became the modern classic Ariel, a book that set the literary world ablaze. Have you read the posthumous poems by Sylvia Plath? Robert Lowell wrote Elizabeth Bishop later that year. They seem about as good to me as Emily Dickinson at the moment, as extreme as one can bear, or rather more so. Reviews of Ariel were extreme as well. In the New York Times, Dennis Donahue wrote that her poetry shows what self-absorption makes possible in art. English critic David Holbrook called that art a poisoned chalice. Feminist critics read Plath as a martyr in the war between the sexes. Plath was a lightning rod, and her legacy loomed uneasily over a generation of women poets. Aftershocks of Plath's death may always follow her, as if she were a Marilyn Monroe of the literati. But time has also changed the way we see her. It's as if the tragedy of her death is beginning to burn away to allow us to read her in new ways. Heather Clark is working on an upcoming Plath biography.
I don't think we read the work as much through her suicide as we used to.
She was very much of her generation, Clark says.
I think she really has more in common with the Beat poets than we realize, because the Bell Jar is sort of her version of Allen Ginsberg's Howl. That might sound like a strange comparison, but it's as much a work of social protest as it is a narrative of mental illness and recovery.
Clark notes that we're studying Plath in new ways as well. Now that Ted Hughes is dead too, Plath scholars and Hughes scholars, long embattled, are looking at their collected papers as a unit, examining the two literary lions side by side. And perhaps we read Plath differently now because we've changed too. I'd like to believe that women have made so many strides in the last 50 years that Plath's legacy can haunt us less. Reading Plath now, I admire how her writing breaks boundaries, explores the ambivalence of motherhood, and plays in new ways with female roles. The voice she crafted is macabre, tender, theatrical, subversive, and even funny. Her poems are otherworldly. They document mid-century life even as they unsettle it.
These little globes of light as sweet as pears. Kindly with invalids and mawkish women, they mollify the bald moon.
Hearing the poem Candles, in which Plath addresses flickering lights around her nursing child, I think of how much she struggled both to be heard as a woman and to be part of recorded time.
The eyes of the child I nurse are scarcely open. In 20 years I shall be retrograde as these drafty ephemerids. I watch their spilt tears cloud and dull to pearls. How shall I tell anything at all to this infant still in a birth drowse? Tonight, like a shawl, the mild light enfolds her. The shadows stoop over like guests at a christening.
Retrograde? Hardly. A half century later, Sylvia Plath's poems live on.
That's Tess Taylor, who teaches poetry at the University of California, Berkeley.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Sometimes it takes a while to get into a story as a reader. It requires patience. Other times, a first line can just grab you, like this one. Mister hit Josephine with the palm of his hand across her left cheek, and it was then she knew she would run. It's a line from Tara Conklin's debut novel, The House Girl. Tara Conklin joins us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Tara, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
It is a really powerful first line of a story. Who is Josephine, and describe what she's running from?
Josephine is a house slave on a failing tobacco farm in Virginia, and she's an artist. She's running from the circumstances of her enslavement, basically, from her master, whom she calls Mr., and her mistress, whom she calls Mrs. Lou.
This is the dominant storyline in the book, but there is another parallel yet intertwined story that you tell as well about a young woman named Lena Sparrow. And her story takes place more than 150 years later, in the year 2004. Lena is a young corporate lawyer. She's just landed the case of a lifetime that sets her out on a search. Describe what Lena is searching for.
Well, her job is to find a lead plaintiff to lead this slavery reparations lawsuit that her law firm has decided to take on as sort of a special project for a big client of theirs. And so her role is to find a face for the lawsuit, a descendant of an American slave who can speak to the nature of the harm in lawyer speak, who can sort of represent this massive, really, you know, unimaginable harm that was slavery in America.
When Lena is doing her research, trying to figure out the nature of the harm, it's really interesting. You devote almost two entire pages to names, just a long list of names of slaves, accompanied by this chart indicating whether the slave endured physical abuse or was denied an education or separated from his family or her family or murdered. Why did you decide to do that? I mean, you could have left it out. There's nothing in this section that directly relates to the plot.
Yeah. I did that because, you know, I really felt from the very beginning of writing this story that it was not a book about slavery. It's a book about Josephine Bell, who is a slave. But at the same time, I wanted to get across some idea of the scope. I mean, I felt like I would be remiss if I didn't try to do that. And so those pages are my attempt to give some suggestion of the enormity of this harm, instead of just a faceless, nameless, you know, mass of people, to actually say these names and have them written down. And those are the real names. Those are names of real slaves. Hmm.
There is some revisionist history that comes to light through your story. And I'm talking about the woman of the house on the plantation where Josephine works. This is Luann Bell. What about that did you want to explore?
Well, I thought, you know, as I was doing the research, you know, I read a lot of slave narratives. And the thing that struck me is that, you know, 250 years of slavery, and there are so few accounts of what their lives were actually like. And, you know, I started thinking a lot about who writes history and what are the voices that we don't hear. And so that was one of the influences that went into, you know, me setting up that situation where Luann Bell takes credit for Josephine's art. And then over the years, over the decades, Luann, you know, achieves a fair amount of fame when, in fact, Josephine was the artist.
I hope you don't mind me saying so, but a lot of the characters, maybe even most of the heroes in this story, are white people. Lena, who is pursuing the truth of Luann Bell and Josephine, the family of abolitionists, the Rounds family. Did you think about that? Did you have any sense of trepidation about that when you were constructing this story?
You know, to be honest, I didn't. First of all, I didn't because I never thought anyone was going to read it. I mean, I you know, I literally wrote this in my pajamas, you know, in my bed late at night. So the idea of anyone having a reaction to it was not something that really crossed my mind until much, much, much later. And I mean, to me, the heart and soul of the novel is Josephine. And she was the character that I sort of fell in love with from the very beginning. She was the character that I had dreams about and that I really worked the hardest to get right in the book. So I guess I never felt that it was more about, you know, the white characters. I really think Josephine is the driver.
Tara Conklin joined us from KUOW in Seattle. Her new novel is called The House Girl. Tara, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Samson Davis, make that Dr. Samson Davis, has a lot of his life tied up in Newark, New Jersey. And Newark and a lot of other inner cities have a lot tied up in him. Dr. Davis wrote a previous book, The Pact, about an agreement he made with two high school friends to become doctors. They did. And in a new book, he describes his experience from returning to be an emergency room physician in the Beth Israel Hospital in Newark, in which he was born, in a way that shines light on the particular needs of health care in inner-city America. Samson Davis's new book is Living and Dying in Brick City, An ER Doctor Returns Home. Dr. Samson Davis joins us from the studios of WBGO in Newark. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, a lot of people, with the blessings of their friends and family, would have gotten out of inner city Newark, gone to medical school, and then become a plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills. What made you come back?
You know, for me, my calling was a bit different. It was important for me to come back and to become a beacon of hope, if you will, to show young people, especially, that education can change a life, and it changed my life and it saved my life in so many ways.
Your book opens especially dramatically because you recognize an old friend who comes into the emergency room, Don Moses, or Snake. Mm-hmm. How'd you know him?
He was a young guy that I grew up with in the streets of Newark, and my past wasn't always perfect. I grew up in a single-parent home, five siblings, drug-infested community, and I always had hopes and aspirations of doing more with my life. But I often say you can't aim for what you can't see. Growing up, I was surrounded by so much negative peer pressure and negativity. It wasn't long before I became a part of that fabric. And Snake and I was a part of a team that committed a armed robbery when I was 17 and a half. And I often say 17 and a half because had I been 18, my story would have been written differently. Yeah. But it was that life experience that changed me around, and I was sentenced to 2 years probation, and I started back in high school and received and earned straight A's in high school, went off to college, and went down a different side of the fork in the road towards education. And Snake Don Moses stayed down the same road of crime, and he was in and out of jail. And so happened after I finished college and went off to medical school, came back home for my residency and was doing my trauma residency. And the first day I started my trauma residency, I looked up at the board, and there's Don Moses written on the board in the trauma room. And I'm like, wow, I know that name. And right below was written the words deceased. So I'm sitting in there looking at the board saying, what are the chances that this is the Don Moses that I know? And unfortunately, I sprinted down to the surgical ICU, and it was his body was taken away, but his family was there, and it was the Don Moses that I knew from childhood.
I'm embarrassed to say it hadn't occurred to me until I read your book that the threat of suicide and the problem of depression in inner-city America might be disproportionate, too.
Yes, it is. I mean, when you look at mental illness in the inner-city community particularly, it's taboo. It's almost like I can't say to another person that I'm depressed because it destroys, especially if it's a man talking to another man, it destroys the man code, if you will. But in the book, I refer to a young man that I grew up with who was this bright, happy young guy who I remember playing basketball with. And I left, went off to college and medical school. When I returned, he didn't look the same. He tried to act as if he was happy, but I mean, everything about him screamed depression. His depression stemmed from many things. He lost his mother, he lost his girlfriend, his fiance, and he never sought help for it because it was one of those situations that I've come to understand that it's, you just don't talk about it. He unfortunately took his life. He just spiraled out of control. He had no resources and no ways of dealing with it or coping with it.
Toward the end of this book, you decide to leave Beth, what you call Beth Israel. Call it Beth, almost like a family member. Now, you're still involved in Newark. But what can be done to bring more medical care, including more doctors, into inner city areas?
I think one is attention to the matter at hand and to realize that there is a need that exists in the inner cities as far as health care, not only in the inner cities, but in a great amount of rural areas as well. I also feel that there has to be a program in place that encourage youth from the beginning to become doctors, to become healthcare professionals. There has to be more programs that exist that's in place to help the students matriculate through high school, through college, through medical school. Because more often, just like myself, you come back to home. Mm-hmm. Through my mother's way of handling life, she always made sure that I understood the need to give back, to come back and to help. She always said, once you make it, you have to come back and help other people. Too often, in Newark especially, I see so many professionals that do make it out, they don't return. And I think that's a crime in itself, that you have to have some social consciousness to give back, to be a part of making a better tomorrow.
Dr. Samson Davis, he has left Beth Israel in Newark, but he continues to practice medicine in New Jersey and travel the country to offer advice on medical care in inner cities. His new book, Living and Dying in Brick City, and the Air Doctor Returns Home. Samson Davis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.